This meeting is now being recorded.
All right, so now I'm just going to mute all the lines, and then we'll get started.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
Okay, so we're going to get started. We really appreciate everyone's coming. As we said in the email, we're going to have some meetings that are broader outreach, that are kind of for general Q&A. That's not what this meeting is. This is really us trying to get input because we find ourselves making really tough decisions about how to rank our top three charity contenders. And so everyone on this call is someone whose input we really have appreciated in the past and would really appreciate on this call. And so feel free to ask whatever questions seem relevant. And I think I sent out a document. This is Holden speaking, by the way. I sent out a document with kind of what we see as the major considerations, the major pros and cons of the contenders for top charities. I'm going to start off by going ahead and summarizing the document because I know that not necessarily everyone got a chance to read it. I'm going to summarize the document. I'm going to give a quick overview of where we stand. And, there's not total internal consensus at GiveWell about where we stand and how we should rank and how we should allocate. So I'm going to give a quick overview, and then it's really most of this call is going to be focused on letting you guys drive it. So to break down where we stand right now, I'd say that there's kind of three main factors we're thinking about conceptually for the top charity contenders, and I think we're not really going to get into why these three because this call is really oriented around trying to make a decision. And the three factors are one, like, is what they're doing, what is the likelihood that this is kind of effective in making people's lives better in the developing world? And usually we're very focused on evidence. I think there's this unusual case of cash transfers where certainly we feel that, the burden of proof is different from how it usually is for developing world aid, and different of those among us feel differently about how true that is. The second question is kind of, all right, so how strong is the evidence or how strong is the case that this thing is helpful? Then there's a cost effectiveness, a bang for your buck question. And we're largely feeling right now like we're largely inconclusive on that question, but I'll talk a little bit more about it in a second. And then the third question is, how do we feel about the organization? Is this an organization we're confident in? Is this an organization that, we feel has kind of, basically, when you support a charity, in our view, you're always supporting the organization, and you're always making a bet not just on the thing that they're doing, but on who's running the organization, how they're going to modify what they're doing in the future. You're always giving yourself a chance as a donor to have bigger impact by kind of promoting certain values, promoting certain organizations, and by just getting money and prominence into the hands of particular people. So we don't want to leave that factor lying on the table. It's a very important one. So how those break down, when we talk about the interventions, there's bed nets, there's deworming, there's cash transfers. These are definitely, I think the three best charitable interventions that I know of that we have any reason to really believe can be delivered by more dollars. So there's other interventions like immunizations that have really strong evidence behind them too, but it's not necessarily the case that more money can deliver more immunization. So I think these are three pretty outstanding interventions within the universe of things that, you can deliver in this kind of simple equation of more money, more people reached. Bed nets, I think, have the strongest evidence base. If you're looking for evidence that something improves health outcomes, bed nets, there's 22 high-quality randomized controlled trials that were reviewed in a Cochrane study. They address a lot of different effects of bed nets on different measures of malaria and malaria burden. Five of them look at under 5 mortality. The effects are pretty consistent. The effects are pretty strong. And then there's this kind of macro case, which I think is a lot more inconclusive, but there's no analog to it for other interventions where kind of the malaria community has continued to collect data over time and try to figure out, are these things working in the field as well as they did in the studies? Then there's deworming. Deworming, I think the evidence is less strong, but still strong in the scheme of things. So deworming is basically there's these pills. We know that they kill parasites, and that's proven. But the question is, what is the significance of these parasites for quality of life? And that's something that we don't know very much about. A year ago, I think we were saying that kind of we saw pretty good evidence that that parasites were associated with subtle general health impacts, things like hemoglobin levels, and pretty weak and questionable evidence that parasites were associated with kind of later in life impacts, that people could earn more money later in life if they were dewormed early in life. Our view has shifted a little bit. I think we've, on one hand, there's a new Cochrane review that came out this year that to me makes it actually look less likely that there's kind of that you can pick up these health impacts, these short-term health impacts from deworming. On the other hand, we did kind of a deep dive into one of the studies that was arguing for longer-term effects. We had a lot of concerns about this study, and in our deep dive, we didn't address all the concerns, but we did address some of them, and we came out more confident in the study than we were a year ago. So overall, I think we feel better about deworming than we did a year ago, and a lot of that, well, that's all because of this deep dive we did on the study where the authors shared their data with us, and we were able to look around a little more and address some concerns. But basically, you know, the way I'd put the case for deworming, I think, is that there's one randomized controlled trial-ish study in Kenya where people were followed for about 10 years after getting a couple years of deworming. People who were dewormed within those who were kind of working for wages had significantly higher wages, about 25% higher, and that's really impressive. And then there's issues. It's only one study. It was done in a really unusual circumstance where kind of El Nino contributed to really strikingly high infection rates that were well beyond normal. There's some other issues. I won't get into all of them at this moment. And then there's another study, which is not a randomized study. It's an analysis from the early 20th century in the American South in a hookworm eradication campaign that found quite similar, even quantitatively similar results, but again, using a methodology that we think was strong enough to be worth considering, but also, you know, pretty far from conclusive. So that's deworming. And then cash transfers is just a very different case. We've already gotten one question. I mean, why do we think the burden of proof is different for cash transfers? You know, I'm not going to get too much into this. I think it's partly an intuition thing, and I think partly our job is to be clear about why we're ranking what we're ranking and let donors decide for themselves. I think people's intuitions diverge a lot. Some people think that cash by default should be, like, there should be a very high burden of proof for arguing that what you're doing is better than cash. Some people are very skeptical that cash transfers help at all, and have an easy time believing that bed nets or deworming are better. But to quickly articulate the intuition, I'd put it a couple ways. One is, if you can get 90% of your donations directly into the hands of very poor people, then they are the ones who are deciding what to buy with it. And, you know, in theory, they can buy deworming pills, they can buy bed nets. In practice, this may not happen so much, and it's an interesting question why that is. And there's lots of different theories. But there's certainly a perspective that says, instead of spending money on aid recipients' behalf, we should get the money to them and let them spend it as they want. And how you feel about that really depends on whether you kind of have higher trust in the logic of these people got money and now the power's in their hands, or higher trust in the logic of, well, GiveWell did this analysis and bed nets are shown to have these effects according to these studies. I think it's a pretty debatable question. Another perspective I'd give in defense of the idea that there's an argument for cash transfers is that, you know, in a lot of studies, and including the deworming one of the outcomes we look for is income. That's one of the things that we consider a meaningful outcome. It's probably actually the single thing that I consider the most meaningful outcome. And so there's this perspective that says, well, if higher income is proof that a job training program worked or that deworming worked, it's also proof that a cash transfer worked. It's the same outcome. It's just a question of what's the numbers? What are the numbers? Can you get a higher return by buying something for people than just by giving the money straight to them at a 90% rate? And I think the answer to that is not all that clear. And so that's, you know, that's where we stand. Another couple things to add about cash transfers, there have been a lot of studies of them. It's hard to pick up particular effects because they don't target particular effects in the way that, say, bed nets do. They're not targeting malaria. But they have addressed a lot of concerns. And so definitely the picture we get from the studies is that people are generally spending the cash transfers on things like better food, on things like livestock or tin roofs, that kind of are investments that are kind of lasting ways of making their lives better, generally spending the cash in pretty reasonable ways. And a lot of the concerns that people might have, that it makes people dependent, that it makes them work less, that it distorts incentives, that it causes inflation, a lot of the concerns have been looked into, and at least the preliminary evidence is that these aren't a big deal, that people actually do reasonable things with the money. They're not spending most of it on alcohol. They are spending most of it on things like food and investments. So that's the situation on the interventions. I think that was probably the longest of the three sections, so I'm going to try and be quicker about the other two big factors that we see. One factor is the organizations. So here, you know, I'd say AMF and GiveDirectly are both organizations that have just consistently really impressed us with just their transparency, their self-evaluation, their self-criticality, the way that they respond to all our critical questions, the ability we've had to understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, how they're thinking, what's going on, how it's going, what the impact of our dollars are. They've just been really good. And we feel really comfortable getting money to the people running those organizations and giving them discretion to do what they think is best. And so those are, you know, those are organizations we both feel really good about. I think there's also a bit of an upside to both of them. There's kind of a potential, you could imagine that AMF is doing bed net distributions, we think, with a higher degree of self-evaluation and transparency than normal bed net distributions. If they could have an impact on the larger malaria community, they would really have a magnified impact. They also kind of set an example for other charities, arguably. GiveDirectly, I think, is a very different kind of upside. They're doing something that doesn't have a big community around it. They're doing something that's actually very, very unusual for charities. And I think that's interesting because I think that they're the kind of group that's going to experiment a lot, going to uncover a lot of new information, and we're going to learn a lot more about the arguments for and against cash transfers, about the best ways to structure them, the best ways to do them. And I think that these sorts of things can create public goods and have magnified effects. And then SCI, I think this organization, I want to say I think it's outstanding in the scheme of things. They're transparent. We've never had a problem with like them not allowing us to share something. Definitely, the guy running SCI, I think he has in the past. He's gotten programs to go forward. He's gotten the programs to happen. He's gotten evaluation done. There's a bit of a track record there. So overall, I mean, this organization has a lot of impressive things about it, but it's not the same dynamic. It's not the same, you know, degree of really feeling that we understand what's going on, how the money's being spent, how things are going. We don't feel that. And we've spent, I think this is a change from last year, because last year we got SCI some money. We followed them over the past 12 months and do not feel that we have gained the same kind of clear understanding of what's going on that we have with the other two charities, and we don't have the same confidence in the organization that we have in the other two charities. And then the third factor is cost effectiveness. What's the bang for the buck? This is something that we're going to be writing about. I think that there's just a huge number of question marks here. Bed nets, we've said for a long time, are in the range of $2,000 per under five lives saved. Our number went down throughout the course of the year, and then it went up because of an adjustment we made, but still in that basic range. And, you know, there's a lot of other benefits of bed nets, too, that are much harder to quantify. They may have the same impacts as deworming. I think there's a good case that they have comparable impacts to deworming in terms of improving early in life health and leading to later in life earnings. And there is one study similar to one of the deworming studies arguing this, and similar in many ways. But deworming is something, and these more subtle impacts are something that has just been very hard for us to quantify. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on how seriously you take the studies, how likely they are to be replicated, what you want to do about the fact that they may not have taken place in representative conditions, how much moral value you place on these impacts, these kind of higher earnings impacts, as opposed to saving a life. And there's just a very wide range. And then when you start trying to compare that to cash, it's extremely hard to make these comparisons. It's kind of like, honestly, it feels like every time we go back to these numbers, there's a lot of subjective factors, and we try to change them, and then the numbers change wildly. That said, you know, I think that our latest crack at the numbers, I think, has kind of, you know, deworming maybe also in the $2,000 per life saved equivalent range, but it, I mean, really, it could be 50, and it could be 20,000. According to our numbers, I think it looks like in general, deworming is generating high financial returns over time that are probably greater than what people could generate on cash, but it's not something we're highly confident in. It's not something we feel that we've nailed down. There are big questions about how likely this study is to be replicated. I think we've been looking at some of the work of John Ioannidis in the world of medical studies to try and get some kind of benchmark for this. And, you know, what does it mean when you have one study? How likely is that to be replicated next time? And it's a very hard comparison to make. So, you know, we're largely feeling pretty inconclusive on the cost-effectiveness comparison. Deworming is very cheap. It's like 50 cents per person served all in. And, you know, there's a good chance that it's the most cost-effective of the three, but it's not something that we are confident in, and it could easily also be way less cost effective than the other things. So that's how we see the main factors. And to talk about where we're tentatively standing, I think we're tentatively thinking that AMF is number one, GiveDirectly is number two, and SCI is number three. It's a combination of the factors that I said. I think the organizational factor is a major thing that would, in order for us to rate SCI more highly relative to the other two, we'd have to believe that its intervention was really way better than the other two. We don't really feel that it's better than either one with enough confidence to do that. And then AMF versus GiveDirectly, I think there's some differing opinions. I mean, I personally don't feel there's a great case for one over the other, but I think the consensus of staff is that it's unlikely that the cash transfers of like $1,000 per family are getting systematically as well spent as the $5 or $6 that dies of bednet, because bednets do seem to have pretty significant impacts. So that was a lot, and we've already gotten a lot of questions.
Yeah. So maybe the way that we'll the way I think we'll move forward is some folks are sending questions. I think the thing we'll do is I'll say the name of the person as Ezra. I'm going to read out the question, and if you'd like, you could unmute your phone when I do that, in case you want to follow up on your own question, and that's probably the best way to keep things organized. You can unmute your phone by hitting *6, and you can send in a question to info@givewell.org. So Dan asked a question about, you know, giving to GiveDirectly and thinking about the moral case to give to people who are poor, but nonetheless the donation is not going to save a life. Versus giving to something like AMF, where, you know, if you give, your, you know, the odds are based on the evidence that you're going to be saving a life. So, you know, in sort of weighing the different things against each other, you know, you could, through GiveDirectly's intervention, give a couple $1,000, you know, about $1,000 to two families, and then, you know, AMF, we'll estimate it's around $2,000 to save a life. I think that type of moral calculus is one that everyone needs to go through, and, you know, if the core moral value is saving lives relative to improving lives, then certainly AMF seems to me like the best, you know, the best way to give to literally save lives. I certainly think that, you know, this is something that varies between different GiveWell staff members, so I guess for now I'll just speak for myself, but, you know, it certainly doesn't seem obvious to me that, you know, the saving a life is the only thing that, you know, I want to accomplish, and, you know, weighing the, you know, the degree of improvement in lives is definitely something that I'd want to do in thinking about, you know, whether I give to AMF to save a life or give to SCI or give directly, which are, you know, more on the improving lives side of the scale.
Yeah, I mean, I'd want to address something that I see as a kind of an implicit intuition behind Dan's question, which is you're kind of comparing, you know, healthy but poor people in Kenya to healthy but poor people in America, and maybe feeling that that isn't, you know, it's hard to justify giving to the former over the latter. And I want to emphasize that the people getting cash transfers from GiveDirectly, from everything we've seen, and I think we feel pretty strongly and very confidently about this, they're very, very poor and just at a level that you will not see in the United States, like pretty much ever. And they're even very poor by Kenya standards. And if anything, I mean, if there were a change I'd like to see, I'd almost like to see GiveDirectly not trying so hard to target the very poorest people, because I wonder about whether the targeting itself might be causing problems. But this is something that I think is going to evolve over time and is certainly debatable, and we've discussed it with GiveDirectly, and their perspective, I think, is intelligent. So I don't want to make too much of that, but the the thing is that they're going to some of the poorest villages in the areas they're working in Kenya, and they're finding people whose, like, houses are made of nothing but mud and thatch. And that's, that I think is something that you don't really see in the U.S., and those are the people who are getting the transfers. And, we've written a lot about the differences in poverty between the U.S. and developing world, but they're really huge, and people who are skeptical about them, I mean, this is something that I think there's a lot of value in visiting the developing world to see this, although the numbers absolutely bear it out as well.
So maybe just to make it a little more concrete, because I was in Kenya visiting GiveDirectly a couple weeks ago, and so, your average GiveDirectly recipient, lives in a three-room hut that is probably 15 by 15 feet, where there's a, one main living room with a few chairs and a table, and then a small bedroom, and a small little storage room. There's 6 to 8 people who live in the household.
Electricity.
People don't have access to electricity, don't have access to running water. The single most common use of the GiveDirectly transfer among the first groups is buying an iron sheet roof to replace a thatched roof. And the reason that people – that costs around $500, though it varies based on the size of the house and the grade of the iron that people choose to buy. But basically what many people told us about the benefits they got from the program is they went from living in a situation where when it rained heavily, which it does in Kenya pretty frequently, their roof would leak, and they would have to move all their children out of the house, all their stuff out of the house in the middle of the night because water's coming in and the floor, which is made of mud, is getting all muddy. And the transfer enabled them to buy this tin roof where they no longer have to replace their roof so frequently. They were replacing the roof, at a cost of about, the thatched roof at a cost of, $12 to $15 every time, about 4 times a year. So it's a costly process. It's a time-consuming process. And the tin roof enables them to avoid that and be significantly more comfortable. The other most common uses after just replacing the roof were things like buying livestock, which people said they did because they would buy the livestock when the cow or goat was young, and then they'd be in a position to use the milk and sell the milk from the livestock as the animal aged, and then also as when they had children who were ready to go to secondary school, the family could potentially sell the livestock and pay for secondary school. The other common use was food. About, I think, 4 or 5% of the transfers have been spent directly on food. I talked to a man who had spent, bought a just gigantic bag of maize, which he was going to keep. People are making their own choices on how to spend it on what to spend it on. And, they seem to be spending it on, pretty core basic things that are helpful and, not the types of, but very basic needs that I think, the needs there are so much greater than the needs here. So that was just about kind of the differences between, how GiveDirectly is tracking their own spending and like Holden said before, the evidence from other cash transfer programs around the world is that, there's no real evidence that there's a significant increase in spending on, quote-unquote bad things like alcohol or drugs or gambling. Now, people may not report it, but, there's not a lot of evidence that, that is going on.
Yeah, I want to emphasize the food thing, too. I mean, we wrote a blog post a few years ago called Hunger Here versus Hunger There that compares hunger in the U.S. to hunger abroad. They have completely different definitions because what counts as hungry abroad is, like, really malnourished to the extent that it starts affecting weight and height. And this is, you know, so rare in the U.S., especially for children, that it, you know, it's not even kind of, it's generally that the stats are done using completely different things. Like, you know, did you have all the food that you wanted to eat, at every point in the last period X? And if the answer is no, then you get put in some classification of hunger. And I think this is relevant to the alcohol point too. So we just had a question, you know, do people spend the money on alcohol? And if they say they don't, how do you trust them? I think I don't fully trust the current data. I think it does not prove that people are not spending money on alcohol. I think there are ways to get better and better data on these kinds of things. But maybe we shouldn't get into that now because I don't think we've been proven that people don't spend the money on alcohol. I think we have suggestive evidence. But, you know, one thing that is definitely an intuition that occurs to me is that when you have the kind of diets that a lot of these people have, it's pretty believable to me that the first thought would be how can you get more and better food before these other things come up. And that's not to say that no one ever spent it on alcohol or that we know that this never happens, but I wouldn't guess that's where most of the money's going.
Related to this, we had another question about how closely are the recipients being watched and maybe the fact that they're being watched is leading them to spend the money better. You know, GiveDirectly does check in with the recipients soon after they receive the grant, but I don't know. I wouldn't have a lot of confidence that monitoring is leading people to spend the money better than they otherwise would. I think, you know, going with a cash transfer as a you know, successful intervention, I think relies on the fact that you believe people in this position are likely to spend the money well and, you know, not waste it. And I think, you know, the available evidence suggests that's what people are doing. I mean, there's just, you know, very little evidence out there that the other, you know, that these negative uses of cash are happening.
Yeah, another point that I'd make on the you know, another point in, I think in defense of cash in a way is I think it's easy to forget being in the U.S. What liquidity can mean to people who really don't have certain methods of financial management and, you know, maybe so strapped for cash. You know, I think in the U.S., a lot of people with their money, they don't know where to save it. It's hard to get a good return on it. In the developing world, it's very common for, you know, microfinance institutions to consistently collect from the same people over and over again at this 25% rate of interest. And the studies that have been done, I think in some cases this is people getting into debt, but in a lot of cases it's not. And there's a decent number of documented cases of people getting returns on their cash that would seem very high in America by doing things that are pretty simple. And so, you know, things like buying a tin roof so that you don't have to constantly fix your mud and thatch roof, buying, you know, a motorcycle if instead of renting it by the day. There's a lot of things where you may have to shell out a little bit every day, and there's no way to make a lump sum purchase. And making a lump sum purchase can save you a lot of money, can be a really good investment in ways that can be hard to kind of intuit if you're used to the U.S. So this is something that perhaps we should write more about. But I think that's another point is that, you know, a lot of these people do have, in a sense, high investment returns open to them, and a lot of them may not.
So just to, we've been talking a lot about GiveDirectly and cash, and one other question that Tom had asked about GiveDirectly before we move on to some other organizations is whether there's any evidence of leverage or multiplier effects from the transfers coming through beyond just the impact on the recipients. I don't think there's any, you know, direct evidence of larger impacts beyond the, you know, intuition that as you bring money into a community, it's going to help not only those who directly receive the cash, but other people in the community. One anecdote of someone we met, which just syncs up with intuition, is, you know, in the community, one person got the cash transfer and they wanted to replace their roof, and they needed to hire another person who drove a motorbike to take them into the city to buy the tin roof. So, you know, I think it makes sense that those types of effects exist with cash, though we haven't seen direct evidence of it.
Yeah, I mean, one just very general comment here, which is just a discussion we've had a ton at GiveWell, is that I think among a lot of people, and, you know, some of these are donors, some of them are in the aid community, there's this intuition that we must be able to do better than just giving our money to the poor, that there must be a way to leverage it and to, you know, to create all this higher return. And, you know, that may be right, but I personally am not convinced. I think there are such opportunities for, you know, for maybe large-scale funders who specialize in certain areas, who fund really innovative things. But, you know, when we're talking at the level of kind of delivering bed nets, delivering deworming, you know, I'm really not convinced that we are seeing better opportunities for leverage than poor people see for themselves. That is my intuition. Other people may have different intuitions and certainly would like to hear them. So I think this is very much a judgment call and very much an open question. But to me, you know, I don't look at this cash transfer 90% thing and think, boy, that's horribly inefficient and expensive and I should be able to do more. I think, you know, that's good. I mean, 90% of my cash got to people who needed a lot more than I do and who may have opportunities to do things for themselves that I would never have thought of. Seems good to me. It seems competitive with other things. But again, it's an intuition. It's a judgment call.
So one more quick question came in from Dario on cash. Can you discuss a bit what distinguishes cash transfers from microfinance and why the case for one is potentially much stronger than the other? Holden, you want to answer that because we were just discussing.
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
The distinguishing between cash and microfinance. Why do you have all these intuitions about cash and not microfinance?
Yeah, so that could be, I mean, that could be a long conversation as well. I mean, microfinance, I think, is usually the goal of a microfinance institution is to seed institutions that then become self-supporting. And it's not to kind of subsidize loans. And, in fact, I think subsidizing loans would just be incredibly inefficient compared to give directly in terms of just like the amount of monitoring you would have to do for a kind of dollar of subsidy delivered. So I actually think they're in very different categories. I don't think microfinance is something that you can compare to cash in terms of having a comparable like ratio of dollars of yours that are getting to subsidies or grants to the poor versus dollars that you spent. I don't think it's going to compete on those terms. I think the terms it's going to compete on actually are more paternalistic. It's on terms of, you know, well, these people using this money can create this institution that in the end is going to, like, kind of beat the market and survive and sustain itself. And that's a claim that to me requires a higher burden of proof. But, you know, I think it's just important to remember and emphasize and admit that the case for cash depends a lot on intuitions. GiveWell generally demands evidence. That's because we require a high burden of proof to believe that, you know, that people so far away and with such different lives from ours are being helped. To me, the cash structure and the evidence that the cash has reached the people, which I think is strong, overcomes that case and is good enough to start making this competitive with other interventions. But, you know, in the end, GiveWell is our mission statement is not about evidence. Our mission statement is about finding outstanding giving opportunities. We're failing at our job if we don't recommend charities that we think are the best place, the place that we would give to do the most good possible. That's what we're about. And so, you know, we're going with what we believe here. We don't have a kind of an ironclad standard of evidence that we always require. We generally require evidence to overcome things that we think are pretty complex hypotheses.
Holden, can I chime in here for a second? Because I don't know, I've been looking a lot at the – this is Alexander from GiveWell.
Yep.
I've been looking a lot at the evidence for these, and I think you're soft-selling it a little bit. You know, so, like, let's just take an example. Like, you were saying that there's not much evidence on alcohol, but, you know, there's three randomized controlled trials where people were asked about alcohol or tobacco consumption, and none of them showed any effect that's greater than the proportional increase in overall consumption. And I think, you know, one of them, like most, I think two of the three showed zero. You know, those are cases where like, if somebody's lying, we wouldn't necessarily know, and so it's hard to pick up. But, you know, and then there's, you know, dozens of other RCTs that are showing consumption increases, especially on food, from around the world, from different cash transfer programs. So, you know, I mean, I totally agree with you that this is a case where intuitions will differ and intuitions are important. But I just want to be clear, it's not like cash transfers are some untried, untested pioneer innovation that GiveWell is just radically behind. These are cases that are studied a lot and where there are a lot of questions that do have decent answers, even if we don't necessarily know the full story yet.
Yeah, I agree. It's not an untried thing, and there is preliminary evidence, so I agree with all that. I think another thing that I want to put out there, I mean, I think this is going to be a year where I think it's especially important that we are transparent about why we're saying what we're saying, and that, you know, if other people want to say, well, I don't accept this argument, I'm going to point to this charity of GiveWells and not that one, you know, especially in some of these very judgment call type decisions, I think that would be perfectly fine.
This is Phil. You guys hear me?
Yep.
Hey, can I throw out a couple thoughts on GiveDirectly here?
Sure.
I guess I didn't put details in my question into email to you, but I, it sounds like a lot of other folks have concerns about GiveDirectly, and I do too. Quite frankly, my intuitions are virtually 180 degrees away from yours. My intuitions are very negative on GiveDirectly. And it's a long discussion. I won't throw at everything, but a couple things. One, my intuitions are to some extent guided by what I see in the United States, where I'm more familiar with cash transfers, and I think that the record here in the United States, cash transfers to the poor have been at best very mixed in terms of their long-term impacts on the poor. Two, addressing a point you had mentioned about that Alexander had raised, that one of the RCTs says that, for instance, since alcohol is an issue that's been mentioned a few times, that alcohol spending increases at worst in proportion to overall consumption, I think it's a very reasonable assumption. I think it's very reasonable to assume that however the poor in Kenya divide their budget currently, X percent to food, X percent to housing, X percent to gambling, alcohol, or you know, good things and bad things, that if they have twice as much, they'll roughly increase, you know, everything by that same proportion. So I don't think that you can assume that just the good things get extra money. I think it would be very reasonable to assume that good and bad increase in approximate proportion, and therefore that if we sort of isolate on the good, that only a portion of the spending is going to go there. Three, I would draw a quick analogy to U.S. lottery winners. The fact that this kind of bundle of money sort of falls from the sky into their laps for a short period of time, and then goes away after a year or two. Again, I think a lot of folks are familiar with sort of folks who win the lottery or otherwise win lump sums of money in the United States, and a lot of the outcomes are not necessarily very very positive over the medium to long term. Fourth thing, and I'll wrap up. I have other things, but I won't go on forever. I am concerned that this particular charity has only been around for about a year, and that they, you know, they are conducting studies, which I think is good, and there's always the potential that those studies will result in favorable outcomes. But nonetheless, they are essentially an unproven charity, and I think it's such a deviation from what GiveWell has done before, the kinds of charities that GiveWell supported before, that it really just jumps out at me, like, you know, wow, how did they make number two when GiveWell spent, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, however long GiveWell's been doing its thing, and talking about evidence, and then you're gonna give your silver medal to a brand spanking new charity, basically, that's just getting started. It just seems really out of character. And anyways, I'll stop now. I've expressed my points.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I want to respond point by point, because I think this could, you know, I think we want to try and leave more room for other discussions. And, you know, some of this really is just intuitions. I mean, the two major points I'd make are, one, GiveWell's job is to find outstanding giving opportunities, and I think we're failing if we don't do that. And, you know, we talk about evidence for a reason, which is that in a lot of these cases we feel more evidence is needed than we've seen, but we don't feel a need to be consistent. Just because we've been talking about evidence for 5 years means that that's what we have to talk about now. And, you know, for other people who say, well, evidence is what I care about, not GiveWell's opinions, then, you know, then we're being fully transparent that this is something that you can take into account, and you can say, you know, well, you don't want to give directly or recommend it. You know, the other thing I'd say is just this. I think that the reason that we have very different intuitions about cash than we definitely notice a pattern in which we have different intuitions about cash than kind of donors. And I think our intuitions are closer to those of economists and the development community and people who work in development. And I think that there is a reason for this, which is that I think it is easy to draw analogies with the U.S., and I think those analogies are extremely misleading. I think that it's a very different dynamic. I think that the kind of that poverty is qualitatively different. And I think that also that the kind of, you know, the selective dynamics by which one becomes poor or stays poor are also extremely different. And so I think that the, you know, I basically don't see those analogies as good analogies. And what I've seen on how people are likely to spend cash in the developing world makes me a lot more comfortable than anything that I would see from some of the examples that have been cited in the U.S.
So just one more question we had on GiveDirectly to kind of close the loop here is Colin asked if GiveDirectly takes off, might predatory practices emerge to take advantage of people who, you know, get so much money so quickly? I think it's certainly something that could happen, and the possibility of people trying to take advantage of GiveDirectly's recipients is one that, you know, I think we're concerned about and GiveDirectly is concerned and aware of and is, you know, in our view, taking the steps necessary to try and identify problems when they occur by, you know, talking to the recipients at various times in various ways to understand, you know, any potential costs they see to receiving the transfers and the benefits they've got from those transfers.
Yeah, I mean, something I'd add to that is that I see this as the flip side of something that I see as very promising and very exciting, which is the idea that if cash transfers became extremely widespread, you might see commercial sectors popping up to do a lot of the things that charities do now, but with a lot more of the kind of accountability that GiveWell, you know, can't provide and that studies can't provide. And so, the way that things work now is there's a lot of charities going in with their theory of what is best for people, and they give it, and there's kind of no accountability except to donors, and the donors don't impose much accountability, and even when they try, which we try to do, it's extremely hard to get formal evidence and formal studies to tell you these things. So the idea of a sector that was more responsive to the needs of the poor, that was maybe providing a lot of the same things but under a different dynamic, I think there's things about the idea that are scary and things about the idea that are very exciting.
So I guess I just wanted to add one thing on the issue of the evidence for cash and the newness of GiveDirectly, which is that, you know, I think we've always taken the stance that different interventions have different burdens of proof. And I think, you know, cash is one where, you know, whether or not it appears immediately to, you know, to be an effective program, it does seem to me like the burden of proof that giving cash to someone improves their life should be lower than the burden of proof that, you know, many other charitable programs are improving people's lives, whether they're, you know, training programs or what have you, because we can just see the evidence that, you know, when you give someone cash, the collective evidence of academic papers and GiveDirectly's monitoring is that people, you know, generally are using the money to improve their lives in the way that, you know, they most desire. I don't think it's quite the case that GiveDirectly is or cash is an intervention that we're recommending without evidence. It's, you know, the basic framework of seeking the evidence that gives us confidence depending on the, you know, our prior that the intervention is successful is consistent with, you know, with all the organizations that we're looking at. And GiveDirectly too, it's just a case where, you know, the prior is very strong that this intervention is effective. And if, you know, if your prior is very different, that, you know, would likely lead you to a different conclusion. You know, on the newness of GiveDirectly, you know, I do think it makes sense to think about the, you know, the potential consequences of newness and what type of evidence one would seek to be confident that the organization is effective. You know, it's the case that GiveDirectly is now, has gone through, two full cash distribution cycles. It's in the middle of its third cycle. You know, we've seen all the data and the results, and it's all going to be in the review that we publish, you know, of these cycles. And so, you know, I think it's fair to think about GiveDirectly as a young organization that is still finding its way, but one that, you know, is not literally starting up, but is, you know, in its in the midst of replicating a process it's done a few times for the, you know, third or fourth time, that's what it's seeking funding for. And, you know, all signs point to the organization being one that, you know, is going to be able to do that successfully, but, you know, more importantly is one that is, you know, sensitive to and aware of the ways that it can go wrong, so they're ready to, you know, so they're ready to adjust to any problems that come up. So maybe it makes sense now to just to switch gears and talk about some of the you know, the other questions that have come up about other organizations. So let's talk about you know, SCI. So one question that that came in about SCI is, you know, Holden mentioned that, you know, SCI has been an organization we've had trouble communicating with and getting all, you know, feeling as confident in how the organization is running and making decisions as the other top organizations. And so a question was, you know, is there any evidence that SCI is improving and whether it's a priority to improve? You know, I think that, you know, we haven't seen the evidence that, you know, that's happening in SCI and that it's a priority for them to improve on transparency and, you know, communication with us specifically. You know, I think the main view that we have of SCI is that, you know, in the event that, you know, you reach the conclusion that deworming is far and away the best charitable intervention, you know, SCI is an organization that has a reasonable track record of turning money into more deworming programs. But, you know, SCI, while its monitoring and transparency stands far, far above the vast majority of charities, it, you know, it doesn't compare to the level of transparency and, you know, self-criticality that we perceive from GiveDirectly and AMS.
Another thing I want to be upfront about, and I'm not sure what to do with this, is that I'm not really confident that SCI's issues are really all about the kind of, you know, that it's all appropriate to present it all as a judgment on SCI. It may be that we just have more trouble communicating with them. I think there's some reason to think this is not the case, and that it's kind of the nature of their communications that are very difficult. I think that's definitely a strong hypothesis. And I won't go into details on that, but I think it's also the case that SCI has gotten stuff done, has gotten programs to run, has gotten results in the past, and so I don't feel like super confident, you know, about this. But you know, but it's kind of something we can't get around. That if you ask me which organization I'm super confident in, and which organization we think we're going to be able to tell you what happened to the money, it's just not on the same level. And that's the thing that I'm confident in, is that it's not, for whatever reason. And the thing I'm less confident in is, like, is this something that's most appropriately discussed as, like, an issue with SCI or an issue with us? I mean, we certainly try as hard as we can.
So another question that came in about SCI specifically was from Dario about the room for more funding with SCI and with deworming in general. So our general impression is that there's a lot of room for more funding globally for more deworming programs. You know, unlike programs like immunizations or vitamin A supplements as a nutritional program, you know, that have had so much success and donor funding behind them that it has been hard for us to find places where money seems like the obstacle. With deworming, it does seem like their funding remains an obstacle. There is, you know, what we're not sure about is the, you know, what SCI is going to do with additional money. I mean, the level, frankly, the level at which we understand what SCI will do is that, you know, in the past, more money in has meant, you know, more programs. With the money that SCI received in unrestricted donations over the past year from, you know, directed from GiveWell and, you know, from other individual donors, they've largely spent that money trying to set up new deworming programs. You know, those have not really gotten started yet. They're just beginning. And so, you know, I don't feel like I have a good answer to the question of, you know, what is the marginal impact of the additional $1 million on what SCI is able to accomplish.
Yeah, I want to add on the macro picture for room for more funding. I have the intuition, although we haven't quantified this, that there's probably less for deworming than for bed nets and cash, in the sense that, like, deworming is very cheap. It's only for, you know, the benefits we see, that the version of it that we would be excited about is only for a certain age group. And it's gaining momentum in the global community in a way that the others aren't. So it's, you know, partly because of these studies, I think we're seeing a lot more interest in it. And, you know, I will not be surprised at all if a few years from now there are no opportunities whatsoever to fund more deworming, and that it's kind of like funded and then some. I think that is much less likely for bed nets, although possible, because there is a lot of money going into bed nets, but with bed nets it's different. I mean, the total amount of money flowing into them is really, really high, and is higher than I think you could spend on deworming. And then with cash, I mean, this is a pretty new innovation, and in theory you could deliver it all over the place and spend huge amounts of money. So if you're looking at the macro picture of, like, you know, is this organization going to influence a giant pot of money down the line, I think it is kind of a smaller pot, and a pot that, you know, there may not be opportunities for individual donors pretty shortly with deworming. On the other hand, if you're looking at the next year, does SDI have enough room for more funding to absorb the money we could get to it? I think the answer is yes.
Another question that came in from Dario about SDI is whether we've done site or office visits to SDI and how those interactions have compared to interactions that, you know, we've had at other times. You know, I've visited with SDI's the head of SDI a few times at his headquarters, and we've done a site visit to a deworming program in Malawi, and, you know, that was all pretty similar to the interactions we've had. I mean, the dynamic is that, you know, as we talk about specific programs with specific questions, we gain some general level of understanding, but SDI's programs are broad and complex enough across, you know, a significant number of countries that it's, you know, hard. We're not able to nail down. We haven't been able, with the time we've spent, to nail down the question of what exactly the impact has been of the organization relative, you know, relative to what would have happened otherwise, in a way that, you know, has been much easier for both, you know, for AMF and I suspect will be significantly easier for GiveDirectly. So I think it makes sense to talk about the comparison of SDI versus AMF, and you know, how they compare to each other. Holden, do you want to answer that?
Sorry, I was trying to make sure that we hit earlier questions. Is this? Oh, is that what you're doing?
Okay. I have everything. Yeah.
Can you say the earlier question again?
Well, just Aaron had this question of is there some reason SDI isn't strictly dominated by AMF?
SDI is strictly dominated, by which he means, you know, is there any consideration that points to SDI over AMF? Yeah, I think there are some. You know, one is just it's a giant judgment call, deworming versus bed nets, and I think it's possible to listen to us saying that and say, oh, that means it's a tie, but it doesn't necessarily. I think we've struggled a lot with what the right intuitions are, and I think our opinion has changed from day to day, but I don't think it would be out of line for someone to look at, you know, look at what we've done with the numbers and say, well, the numbers really favor SDI. I also don't think it'd be out of line to say the numbers favor AMF. So we're kind of calling it too close to call. But I think there's room for disagreement there. I think there's a good chance we're doing something wrong there. Certainly deworming is cheaper than bed nets. So if you're really focused on the developmental effects, if those are what you care about, and if you think they're equally likely for the two interventions, then SDI is the way to go. Another advantage of SDI is that it, you know, there is this potential leverage issue, although I don't want to put too much weight on that because we know very little about it and we haven't really investigated this, and so it's just something that I would raise as something to keep in mind. But, you know, deworming is this thing that's gaining momentum, and, you know, the guy who runs SDI has kind of a, I think, has more of a history of advocacy, raising money from other big funders, getting things to go forward at the government level, and you can imagine that is more leverage than people who really see their job as just delivering your dollars to buy more interventions. You know, we don't have concrete examples of like where we really think SDI got leverage. It could also go in reverse. I think there's a significant risk with SDI that your money is kind of supplementing or being fungible with large donors and with major aid. But yeah, I think those are some considerations in favor of SDI. The real big one to me is that I think there are reasonable ways to believe that deworming is a much better intervention than bed nets. We aren't convinced of that.
I just wanted to add here that, you know, if you took sort of like most famous recent deworming study that Holden was mentioning earlier that we've sort of done a lot of research on this past year at face value, then you would think probably that deworming comes out better. You know, it would depend on how you value impact on quality of life versus quantity of life, because deworming essentially doesn't save any lives, whereas bed nets, the main effect is for saving lives, although they also have a quality of life impact on later, like, income, we think. And so, you know, how you weigh those different factors will have an effect on what you end up coming out with. We basically think that, you know, covering a kid with bed nets for a year probably gets roughly the same developmental impact as covering a kid with deworming pills for a year, and deworming pills are significantly cheaper. And so at that level, you sort of need to weigh how much do you value those developmental impacts, sort of in terms of, like, future income or something else, versus the lives that you can save with bed nets. And there's some sort of equilibrium point where you would break even. You know, that will be formalized in our write-up. But. Sorry, Holden and Ellie, I think, got kicked off the line for a second. They'll be back in just a moment.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yep, you're back.
Okay, cool. Yeah, this is another extrapolative thing we're doing to say that the case for developmental impacts of bed nets and deworming is similar. And, you know, there's very different evidence bases for the two of them on this front. I think that kind of I personally would probably put my money on bed nets having more of a developmental effect because they have, like, convincing, consistent evidence of short-term health impacts. And so if you're looking for a health impact early in life to affect later development, that's what I'd look for. But there is, you know, it's like two studies versus one if you're looking at direct measurements of these things, and probably the single best study is on the side of deworming. You know, this comes back to the GiveWell evidence thing again. I mean, if we can really go one of two ways. We can have rigid criteria that we need, you know, these five boxes to be checked, or we can try to figure out who does the most good using kind of a Bayesian framework of saying this is the starting point we would start from, this is what our intuitions would say, this is how the data informs it. By doing cost-effectiveness calculations, I think it's a good way to not be lazy and to basically make sure your intuitions are maximally informed by data. But if, you know, if you're looking for someone who's checking boxes, I think AMF is just the clear choice. I mean, bed nets have the strongest evidence behind them. They're quite cost effective. It's the only one where we can give you any kind of a, you know, cost per life save type figure with it that we think is even, you know, that we think is even reasonable to bound within certain bounds. And it's a great organization. So certainly, I mean, it's a choice that we face that we're looking to answer this question of how do I do the most good and not checking boxes. But if you're looking for, you know, if that's what you're looking for, then AMF is the choice.
And that sort of summarizes the, I don't know, at some level, like the high-level considerations I feel like we've been weighing as we go through this, as we've been debating how to think about these different donation options over the last, you know, week or two. And, you know, a lot of it comes down to what do you believe about the specific organizations and their ability to use money and the types of decisions they'll make within the intervention that they're running. And then what do you believe about the, you know, the evidence or the likely impact of the intervention? And, you know, a huge issue that we've debated and is clearly an issue we've talked about a lot on this call, is, you know, what do you believe about the impact of cash relative to, programs like deworming and distributing bed nets, which are, you know, much more standard charitable activities? So I think we've run through most of the questions that people have sent in. If, you know, anyone has additional questions to ask now, I mean, feel free to, you know, unmute and talk and ask questions. We're happy to discuss. You know, as always, if you have more questions that, you know, you come up later as you're thinking about where to give, you know, please feel free to send them in. One quick request that I have, if you are open to it, is, you know, one of the things we've debated a lot is how, you know, we each personally intend to allocate our donations across these three organizations, and, you know, what GiveWell should recommend for donors who want to just follow GiveWell's recommendation, so to speak, of how to allocate the funds across the three. And so if, you know, you've thought this through and you have a general position of where you're leaning and you're, you know, open to sending that in, that's certainly information that, you know, would be helpful to us. You know, each person on staff has gone through the exercise of thinking about how they'd allocate donations and, you know, sending in their allocations with an explanation of why. But, you know, we'd certainly appreciate it, you know, hearing that from all of you on this call as people who, you know, have been most engaged in following GiveWell over the years. And, you know, we know have a large stake in trying to make this decision as well as you can.
Yeah, one thing I want to add on that, we've had a fair amount of debates about how, you know, how to even think about this question of how should you allocate money, because there's certainly, I think, a good argument and a good position that says there's no reason to give a dime to any charity other than the one you think is the best, the one with the highest expected value, because it's not, you know, there's no need to diversify, there's no need to kind of worry about risk. What you want is to do the most good possible in expectation, and I think that argument is largely valid. Obviously, if you're a big enough donor, you reach some point where your money has diminishing returns. You wouldn't give a whole $100 million to AFF at once. You'd want to start funding lots of charities. But certainly, you know, this is an argument for someone who's an individual donor that you should give it all to the number one. And the only counterpoint to that I find very compelling is that by supporting more than one charity, you basically gain opportunities to have more information in the future. And it's both in terms of the fact that, like, if these different charities grow and if they have more money, then they'll do more and you'll learn more. But also if the donations are attributable to GiveWell, then GiveWell has more of a seat at their table and GiveWell learns more. And so these are things that when we're thinking about how to accomplish as much good as possible, a major factor is how do we gain knowledge that's going to make our future giving better. A lot of the impact here is impact on future giving, and that's why a lot of these organizational transparency qualities are really important. So when we talk about allocations, they tend to be heavily skewed toward top charities, but they don't tend to be 100%.
Phil here. One quick follow-up. I know you wanted to primarily talk about these three, but if you could just briefly, Village Reach, which was your number one for, I think, at least 2 years, could you give a very brief follow-up on that and why it's not in the top three anymore?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we took Village Reach down from being our number one at the end of last year. And at the time, we did that because we felt that it didn't have, you know, real significant room for more funding for its scale-up of the project that, you know, we liked so much in Mozambique. And so, you know, we basically felt like additional dollars were going to do more in AMF and SCI's hands than Village Reach. Over the course of the past year, we've continued to follow Village Reach. We published an update earlier this year. We're about to publish another one as soon as we work through some of the final details with Village Reach. And now we think they may have room for more funding, though we're not totally sure. But, you know, our view of the, you know, impact of their approach has shifted a bit for a couple of reasons. You know, one is we've gotten more sensitive to the ways in which the type of evaluation that they ran could miss some real important factors that could have led to the results that were measured. You know, in particular, one of the key results they found was an increase in immunization rates in the area that they worked. And a big thing that they tried to find in their evaluation, but you never really can know, is, you know, whether some other actor or other force, you know, whether it's an outside funder or someone in the Ministry of Health, is really the cause of the increase in immunization. And so, you know, one thing that's changed is that we're, you know, now looking more for organizations like AMF, which is, you know, largely delivering a, you know, something proven in a way to people who otherwise wouldn't have it, and that seems like the, you know, the type of program that's more likely to have impact. Another thing that's changed is that, you know, they have really struggled in their scale-up to have the type of impact that they want. They struggled early on with getting the government to even run the program. They worked through that. Then, you know, costs were higher than expected. I mean, all of this is documented on the website. But, you know, those are other reasons why, you know, I think it's, you know, we certainly knew when we recommended the Village Reach scale-up that, you know, it was a relatively risky proposition and that they were trying to do something that was high risk but high reward. And certainly it seems now that their, you know, their program in Mozambique is struggling to have the type of impact that, you know, we and they hoped for. You know, all that said, we really do continue to follow them and, you know, appreciate their continued commitment to transparency. I think it'd be easy for a lot of organizations in their position to, you know, essentially try to walk away at this point and not want to continue to share so much information with us. And, you know, we think it's really great that they are sharing that information because it allows us to, you know, to learn about how programs work and what leads them to go well and poorly. And it also just sets a model for how organizations should behave in, you know, being open to sharing results even when they're not, you know, they're not strictly positive. So if anyone else has any other questions, feel free to jump in. If not, you know, we, again, you know, I'd appreciate it if you have any additional questions, you can send them in and we're happy to answer them over email or one-on-one. You know, if you have a sense of how, you know, you'd allocate your funds, if you think that you know, you feel strongly that we've missed something as it relates to these organizations.
There's one question that we didn't answer that I just saw that I think is worth answering because I think it's interesting. So Phil asks, you know, isn't deworming the thing, unless Alexander already got this, Phil asks, isn't deworming the thing where we debunked this major pro-deworming point about a year ago or 18 months ago? And the answer is yes, and I think it's an interesting story about deworming, which is that basically, you know, as far as we've known for a long time, there's been two major arguments that people make for deworming. One of them is this cost-effectiveness analysis done by the Disease Control Priorities Report that says it's, you know, the best deal, the best bang for your buck, $3.41 per kind of year of healthy life saved. And we got the raw data behind that. We looked at it. It was completely flawed. And corrected came out to about $300 per year of healthy life saved. It was off by about 100x. And, you know, it just the analysis was really just kind of riddled with flaws. And we ended up kind of discarding that as an argument for deworming. And then, you know, the other big argument for deworming has been this study from Kenya where people were followed for 10 years and seemed to have higher earnings. And we did a similar deep dive on that piece of evidence this year and came out more confident in it. And so we really looked at it, and not to say that there's no concerns, but we looked into a lot of things that kind of looked off to us. And, you know, basically I think it made it through our test pretty well. And so that was, you know, just an interesting, I mean, there's these claims floating around, and some of them really do hold up, and some of them really don't. And in deworming's case, it was one out of two. So, Ellie, you were wrapping up.
Yeah. So, unless there's any other questions, we'll wrap up.
Yeah.
I want to jump in with more? Is that another question? Or okay. Shoot.
Yeah. So, what about your other standout charities? Will they still remain standout charities, or are you removing any of them from your list?
We're planning to de-emphasize, remove the standout charities. The reason is that, you know, any charity we recommend, any charity we put our name behind is a charity that we feel we ought to be really doing due diligence on, following, doing updates on, and these things take a lot of our time, and when we look at the amount of benefit we get from having standouts, the amount of money that goes to them, and then how much of our time it takes to understand what a standout has done in the last year, it just isn't a good equation. And it's compounded by the fact that it's actually more efficient for us to do follow-ups on the very best charities because they tend to – it's just easier to get information for them. They have more information. They answer questions more clearly. And so, like, as soon as you start moving down that list, it becomes a giant time sink. And this is, you know, going back to the shift in GiveWell that has kind of been going on for years, which is just always trying to focus on the very best opportunities to do a lot of good by giving your money. And even if that means, you know, not always having rigid criteria, not having something for everyone, but what it does mean is that the few charities we recommend, we're really able to go into very deeply. And the three charities we're recommending, I mean, we've spent an enormous amount of time on, and we've looked at from a lot of different angles.
So you won't have a list of standout charities anymore?
That's right.
That's right.
We're going to take that list of standout charities off the top charities page.
Okay, you'll have it somewhere else that's not emphasized, or...
If you go to a standout, we haven't decided for sure. If you go to a standout charities page, it'll probably still say that they were declared a standout as of a certain date, and that we haven't checked back since then. That's the most likely place.
I mean, it's kind of the the logical conclusion of this evolution that Givel has gone through for a long time, which is to focus more on the organizations that we would give to and that we'd strongly recommend people give to relative to trying to assign ratings to organizations at different levels. And so at this point, you know, we look at the three organizations we feel really good about and those others and the work involved with, you know, maintaining some middle tier of, you know, we generally feel good about this organization, but not nearly at the level of these other three doesn't seem worth the benefit.
But they also play the role of, like, possible future top charities. As in the case of GiveDirectly, it was a standout charity last year. And so are you keeping that
list? I wouldn't really say that. I don't think that standout is a search method for us. I think we certainly are aware of the charities and the interventions that have potential to be top charities down the line. Some of those are, you know, may not be standout. Some of them may be. I think in GiveDirectly's case, you know, they were interesting enough when we found them to be a standout, but we were going to go back to them regardless. We didn't find them by, like, rescanning our list of standouts. We had our own reasons for going back to them.
And, you know, we have other strategies for continuing to engage with charities that we think might have the potential to eventually be top charities but aren't necessarily there yet. So, you know,
right.
We wrote about our work with Cochrane. And so, you know, that's a good example of where, you know, I don't think they're formally on the website as a standout, but we have, you know, an ongoing relationship with them. And so I think there's the potential for future relationships like that that will keep open this kind of possibility.
So another thing you had said at the somewhere in between, that one reason why you want all your money to not go to a single charity you recommend, but rather to be mixed in terms of the charities you recommend, is that it allows you to have leverage with the charities later, as in they are more willing to listen to you and share data with you.
Yeah, that's certainly an argument for GiveWell, you know.
So that's an argument for GiveWell as a whole to try to make sure some money goes to each charity, but it's not an argument for any individual donor to split money between charities. Because any individual donor at the margin is not going to affect the proportion.
So this I actually disagree with. I generally tend to, you know, follow kind of a rule, and certainly in giving money, of giving as I would want people like me to give. And, you know, if people who are fans and supporters of GiveWell and want us to get this leverage are giving in the ratios that we recommend, then the overall pool of money will tend to be closer to the ratios that we recommend, and that will be a better outcome. And so I actually recommend that people give as they would like the larger universe of GiveWell donors to give. That's what makes sense to me. It's, you know, it's a debatable issue, and if you don't care about the benefits of GiveWell's leverage, or you just don't accept this argument of kind of behaving as you would like the larger community to behave, then certainly you can give all to one charity. But
would you be putting out a recommended ratio of giving if you have some? Sorry?
We will be putting out a recommended ratio, and we're not final on it, and part of it is going to depend on what we hear from people, I think, like the arguments, not just the statements. But, you know, what we're thinking of right now is something like 60% AMF, 30% GiveDirectly, 10% SCI. So twice as much to AMF as GiveDirectly, three times as much to GiveDirectly as SCI. That's the tentative ratio we've been playing with, and that's subject to change.
But, I mean, a big
haven't done that in previous years. I mean, this is the first time you'll be doing that.
So last year we did it informally. Last year we had AMF number one, SCI number two, and if anyone asked us, we told them that we were thinking 80-20 was appropriate, and a fair amount of people asked us, and then just from the way that people use the website, it ended up being, like, fairly close to our ratio. I'm not going to claim that we engineered that with any degree of precision or even that we really engineered it at all. We just kind of put up number one AMF, number two SCI, and that's what happened. And that was the first time. I mean, last year was the first time that we anticipated enough money for any of this kind of thinking to even make sense.
Okay.
I mean, so one of the reasons that we anticipate releasing the new recommendations, you know, hopefully early next week. And one of the reasons we wanted to hold this call now before we do that is to get feedback from, you know, all of you about what you think about these issues, and, you know, to the extent that you disagree, sending us, you know, your thoughts and sharing them on the call. But also, if you have thoughts on this allocation question, you know, we're interested in your thoughts on that too.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from anyone who just says, you know, I'm planning to give X dollars to this charity, X dollars to that charity, and here's why. That's really good information for us.
So any other questions, or should we wrap up? All right, well, you know, thanks so much to everyone for joining us. We really appreciate it. Like we said a couple of times, if you have any specific questions or comments on the charities we talked about and, you know, what you think about them and where you're planning to give, you know, we'd appreciate hearing from you. You know, sooner is great. Later is also very helpful. Also, you know, a major goal of ours on this call is to get feedback on our process and research. And so if you have any thoughts about how, you know, we could better make these calls work in the future, we would appreciate that too. Because this is, you know, this is one of the ways in which we get, you know, feedback from people outside of GiveWell about what they're thinking. All right. Thanks, all.
Wait. We have Alexander's saying wait for Dario. Is that?
Dario just asked us. Dario said he had a question. Dario, are you there?
Okay. Well, I think at this point it's probably better to yeah. End the call
Sounds
and
good.
To catch up with him after.
All right. Good night, all.
Thanks for joining, everybody.
Thanks a lot, everyone. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Can someone handle this?
Hi, guys. Is there anyone still on the line? Guess not.